You know what it's like to get stuck talking to a know-it-all? I don't know if you've ever had a conversation with me. I know that you know what it's like because I know it all. At least sometimes I feel that way, which is very bad. I'm not saying it's a good thing. Have you ever sat under somebody, though, who doesn't think they know it all, but it seems like they actually do know it all? Like someone who is actually, you want to keep listening to them because you really, really, really enjoy hearing everything they say. Someone who wants, you would just let them hear them teach and teach and teach or talk and talk and talk, and you finally get around to checking your watch because you're hungry and you're like, oh, it's been several hours. That's why I'm hungry now. Not everyone's like that. I've thankfully met a few people who just pretty much anytime they talk, you're like, I want to take notes and listen because this person's about to spew out wisdom. And thankfully, I had one professor in particular who I got to work for as an assistant for 3 years. And I once heard a student describe Doc this way. Every time he walks into class, he pulls out the pin from a hand grenade labeled knowledge and throws it in. Just every time you talk to the guy, just you learn stuff. And you could sit there and talk with him for hours until he realized he has to get somewhere. I think Jesus would have been someone like that. Someone who he just would have been fun to just hear him talk and go and keep sharing things. Not a know-it-all, even though literally Jesus did know it all, but someone that you would have just loved to hear the guy speak and hang on his every word. Sometimes Jesus' teaching lost him some followers, though sometimes people, they didn't discredit the fact that he could teach, they just said, this teaching's too hard, what am I doing listening to this guy, and they walked away. Some people got offended by what he said. But as we saw in the narrative of the past 3 weeks, Jesus was just naturally a teacher. With Nicodemus, he taught just because of an interaction. With the woman at the well, he started teaching just because he was talking to some lady. With the healing that we talked about last week, he taught during that healing. He taught just in his day-to-day activities. But as any good teacher, and Jesus was the great teacher, any good teacher, though, didn't just talk in passing, but he also spoke and taught in literally just taking time to teach and to lecture. Earlier sermons focused on his teaching in passing. Today we're going to talk about some of his direct teaching. And next week, Alan is going to preach for us and give us some of Christ's teaching through storytelling. But this week we're going to focus on just some pure teaching, not storytelling, not anything, just him, just Jesus, just preaching. We don't have a whole lot of Jesus' preaching and teaching material recorded. We really don't. We've got a few of his sermons. They seem to be smaller and probably not the whole thing. It's just the parts recorded for us that we're supposed to hear today. It's much shorter than any sermons or lectures you'd hear today. The Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' flagship sermon, in English it's about 2,500 words. This sermon is several hundred words longer than that. And my average sermon is a couple hundred words, give or take the same length, a couple hundred words longer maybe sometimes. But while not a lot of Jesus' words were recorded, the ones we do have are very powerful and very weighty, and they're very meaty, good stuff sermons. Today's sermon actually is not that much different in length than the Sermon on the Mount. But while Jesus' Sermon on the Mount was chapters 5, 6, and 7 of the Gospel of Matthew, this sermon's only going to talk about chapter 5, verses 1 through 12 of the Gospel of Matthew. Just 166 of Jesus' words, I'm going to spend a couple thousand, 3,000 words discussing it. I actually did the word count in Microsoft Word. And so his words are a little bit weightier, I think, than mine. It takes me a lot longer to get around to saying something he does. But before I get a little too meta and talking about the sermon, let's just get in the text for today. And so follow along with me as I read out of Matthew chapter 5. And we'll be in verses 1 through 12. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely in my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they prosecuted the prophets who were before you." He continues on teaching, but we're gonna stop in what we're going to talk about today in today's sermon after that verse there. Some of what he teaches later on the Sermon Mount is already planned to be taught a couple months from now, but as we mentioned last week, it's a very fast-paced sermon series, so that's all we'll cover for this series in particular. Matthew chapter 4, right before we get to the verses we read just now, Matthew 4 ends up with Jesus being a celebrity. It's kind of how it is. It's a summary statement of what's happened before. At the end of Matthew chapter 4, it says he heals and he teaches and his fame spreads and crowds are just following him everywhere he goes. And then you get to Matthew chapter 5, verse 1. He sees this great crowd of people following after him, so he climbs a mountain and sits down and starts teaching. He then gives these things as an introduction to his sermon. He gives these things called Beatitudes. And I just don't like the word Beatitude. It's a goofy word. For one, it's hard to type. Those of you who are friends with me on Facebook might have noticed that I made a comment about that. Every time I type the word beatitude, I've got to actually think about the letters that's in the word. Most words I can just type and I don't have to think about it, which sometimes can be some typos. But with the word beatitude, every single time I had to think about how to spell the word, and it was just really annoying to me. And of course, I had to type it a lot while writing a sermon on the Beatitudes. But it's also just a technical term that I've never really connected with. Every time I see the word, I have to think, okay, what does that mean again? Okay, yeah. It's actually a technical word. It's not just in reference to the first 12 verses of the Sermon on the Mount. We noticed that in the reading that Don did for us earlier, that was out of the Gospel of Luke, those were a series of Beatitudes as well that were slightly different in that passage. But it's a technical term for a statement of goodness. You can break it down and say, be attitude. So what attitude you be, what attitude you are or have. And you can break it down like that. It sort of works there. But I still just don't like the word. That's why the sermon is called Beata What. But it doesn't have to use that phrase that we get in the Gospel of Matthew or the Gospel of Luke that starts with blessed are the da-da-da-da-da. What we get at the beginning of the ones in Matthew is that word, but it could be any positive or affirming or pleasant phrase. In the Old Testament, in the Psalms, we see a couple times, or in the Proverbs as well, we see the phrase, happy are those who. That is also a beatitude. Anytime you say, happy is someone who does such and such, blessed is someone who does such and such, anytime you explain why they're happy or blessed or positive or happy-go-lucky, that is when you have a beatitude. But these Beatitudes in particular start with a word that we translate blessed, or blessed are, and that's sort of the word Jesus starts out with, but it's actually a word that's somewhat hard to translate, and usually most translations end up just deciding on blessed, because that just makes it easier, because it's a complicated word. The word blessed is from the Greek word makarioi. It's used elsewhere, and Homer uses the same word. Homer is not the Simpsons Homer, but the Homer who wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. He uses the same word. He uses the adjectival form to describe those who live on Mount Olympus. It was originally a poetic word meant to describe those who are living in some divine state of godlike blessedness hereafter in the Isles of the Blessed. If the word were of Hindu origin, it might be something like saying you're in nirvana. But over time, the word became a little more commonplace and not so much just about living in heaven or whatever the equivalent of that religion's heaven is. But the thought is still there behind the word a little bit. It's something like how fortunate you are, how lucky you are. It's so cool to be you. That kind of phrase is this word for blessed. It's what you'd probably use to describe someone's day after they finish their last day of a cycle of Groundhog's Days. It'd be kind of like that. It's like, man, you're doing awesome, is what that word would be like. Some have suggested that the word should be translated, congratulations are you. But either one works. The form of the word we have in the Beatitudes is not the adjective form, though. It's the noun form. And so it's not describing you as having divine-like living conditions, but you're to be congratulated, but that you are congratulated. You are a blessing. You are doing awesome. Not just you're described as being awesome, but that you are awesome. You're in the state of being of really coolness or blessedness. And with that thought in mind, we'll go on to the first Beatitude and walk through them. But with that thought in mind of you're in the state of awesomeness is what this word blessed means, The first beatitude, which each one should be on the screen as we talk about it, the first one is congratulations to the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Congratulations to those of you who are poor in spirit. It's so awesome to be you, is the phrase that's really there. That's what Jesus is declaring. And it sounds kind of goofy sometimes. I don't know about you, but I don't know if I'm feeling poor in spirit. I don't think I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go rule the world right now. That's sort of what Jesus is saying, though, is those who are poor in spirit, aren't you guys so awesome, is what he's saying there. And scholars debate whether or not this specific beatitude is referring to just people who are poor or not, people who are physically poor in poverty's sake, that concept, but whether or not Jesus is giving the beatitude to literally poor, people who are just poor in spirit, I think he means a little bit more than just poor in spirit. In Luke's beatitude, the similar one, it just says poor, the one that Don read for us earlier. But here, there's that extra little phrase, in spirit. And I think that Jesus is saying that he's talking about those who are poor in spirit because they give so much and they feel like there's nothing left to give and they're sick and tired and they feel like the hamster's been running on that little wheel and he's getting nowhere. The wheels are spinning out, but nothing is happening. And Jesus is saying, you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. Congratulations, isn't that awesome? Is the first beatitude. And why? Here it says, because yours is the kingdom of heaven. And it doesn't really feel that way all the time, but let's see how the rest of the beatitudes play out. See how the rest of these statements of how awesome you are. And while we work through the beatitudes, we're going to run through them very quickly. I want you to keep in mind that this first beatitude, though, and the last beatitude, verses 2 and verse 10, because 11 and 12 are not actually beatitude, their own beatitudes, their clarifications on verse 10, but verse 2 and verse 10, or verse 3 and verse 10, they have the same half phrase at the end of them, for yours is the kingdom of heaven, which is a method called inclusio or inclusion. It's very similar to bookending. Well, bookending, which I've talked about before, is how you know where a story begins and where a story ends. Inclusio, because this is a different type of words here, the Beatitudes, it means that everything's included on top of each other. And so each Beatitude is sort of the clarification or more added onto the same train of thought as the other Beatitudes. And so they're kind of getting thrown into a big pot, and that's sort of what you're getting. And so they're all going to have a constant string of thought throughout them all, and they all kind of clarify each other and point out what the others are supposed to mean. And so keep aware of what that constant string is while we read through. But let's continue on to the next one with, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. One important thing that is easily missed in this one is, I think Jesus is actually referring back to something he said earlier in his ministry out of Isaiah 61, 1 through 4. That Isaiah 61, 1 through 4 kind of parallels the Beatitudes in some ways. In those verses that Jesus actually read at the beginning of his ministry, sat down and said, these are now fulfilled in your presence. So the town ran him out because he just said the poor are no longer poor, the mourning are no longer mourning. It begins with poor, just like the first Beatitude did, and then goes into mourning. But it's important to realize that the mourning in Isaiah 61 is not mourning about, you know, suffering some personal loss, or some other people interpret as, you know, suffering and mourning that you need to repent of some sin. But actually it mentions those who mourn because of the hurt of the people of Zion, God's people. The person mourning in those verses does so because he sees that the righteous are suffering and the wicked are prospering, and they're mourning because God has not yet redeemed that situation. The verses in Isaiah 61 are these, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion to give them beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations. If those verses are accurate and they actually do parallel this beatitude, then this would make this particular beatitude not about those who are mourning because someone died or mourning because of something they did or lost, but the more direct meaning would be those who are mourning the fact that the kingdom of God is not fully here on this world yet. Not everything is how it's supposed to be. They're upset because God's people are not prospering like they should. And the people who are not obviously God's people are prospering. And the writer is upset there. This beatitude then is those who mourn because they look around the world and see just how it is not like what God originally intended. See just much corruption and wickedness there is prevalent around. And Jesus says, congratulations, you who are depressed by seeing the evil in the world. Maybe, though, because you see things like they really are, and you will be comforted, and God will take care of that. Going on to the next beatitude, it says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. It's a reiteration of Psalm 37:11. It promises the exact same thing in very similar words. That description, the meek, is a concept very similar, actually, to the first beatitude, the poor in spirit. The meek and the poor in spirit both share, if you look up what the concepts are, they both share an inability to get something done, is the feeling behind both of those words. The poor in spirit aren't getting things done. It doesn't say why, but the meek, though, the concept of meekness actually explains why you aren't able to affect change in the world around you. And that's while the poor in spirit maybe can't, the meek just simply don't. The meek are not necessarily weak or cowardly or passively resigned to not changing situations of oppressors or other things, but it's that they depend on God for the timing of when they should act. It's the meek hold back what they can do because they're waiting for the right time to do it. They depend on God and they wait for him to effect change or to initiate change. They don't take things into their own hands and just come in crashing and knocking things down. But it's not because they're weak or lazy. It's because they know their ultimate vindication comes from God, and it's up to him to judge and to force the hands of the wicked. That's the idea behind meekness. And Jesus says, blessed are you who are meek, who wait to take action when necessary, for they shall inherit the earth. And going on to the next beatitude, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. In the Psalms, in the prophets, this phrase comes up time and time again, this blessed are not blessed are, but this phrase, who hunger and thirst for righteousness, hungering and thirsting for things that aren't actually food or liquid. We've seen a similar notion in the sermons that I've preached already, though, if you've been following along or just know your gospel stories. Jesus provides to the woman in the well the only water that can actually quench thirst, and he provides the bread that is the only thing that can actually quench hunger, and that bread is the doing of God's will. And he says, blessed are those who spiritually hunger and thirst, but don't fill their stomachs with junk food, if I could add to the phrase. Not literally filling it with junk food, but spiritually filling it with junk food. Blessed are you who go around in this world where there's plenty to eat, but it's not necessarily good for you. Blessed are you who still hunger and thirst for righteousness, because that's sometimes harder to find. Congratulations to you who have a developed palate and know what actually fills. Because guess what? You're going to be satisfied. The next beatitude, it's blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And this beatitude marks a shift in concepts for the beatitudes a little bit. The first four were about someone's just state of being. It's about, yeah, you are you're poor in spirit. Yeah, you are meek. Yeah, you hunger. But the next four require interaction with someone else. They require to be merciful. You can't be merciful alone. It's just impossible. It requires you doing something with someone else. And I think Jesus is clarifying his beatitudes. Now it's not just you who are poor in spirit because you're wishing for a better world, but he's clarified you who are purposefully trying to make a better world. You're poor in spirit, or you're merciful here. Blessed are those who are merciful. And we have to remember that showing mercy doesn't just mean being nice to those who deserve it. It means being nice to those who don't deserve it, because the ones who do deserve your kindness, they don't need your kindness because they're already going to get taken care of in God's ways and God's time. It's those who need mercy are the ones who are not necessarily the ones who need it. They're the ones who need you to be merciful towards them. And Jesus says, guess what? If you're merciful, you will be shown mercy. Continuing on to the next beatitude, it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And just like the other beatitudes, this one parallels some stuff in the Old Testament as well. And in fact, Jesus actually hardly brings any new teachings to the table. He comes up with very little original thought in the Gospels. Most of everything he says is just paralleling stuff in the Old Testament. He clarifies a few things, but really it's his actions that are most important and are most what did something for us. He fulfills the Old Testament prophecies. So the concept of Jesus and the things he teaches were around for a long time, and that's why I think when people say the Old Testament God is this mean and vengeful God, I want to respond, you haven't read the Old Testament enough, because the Old Testament God is extremely loving, too. He does do some harsh stuff, but read the rest of the story. Don't just leave it there. Stop taking things out of context, really, is what you want to respond with, because Jesus doesn't bring that much new to the table. He just fulfills what was already at the table. But in this Beatitudes case, Psalm 24, verses 4 and 5 are the parallel to this one. And those verses, I happen to have them in my notes, are, "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully, he will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation." It says, "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, he will receive a blessing." And Jesus says, "Blessed are the pure in heart." But that's the kicker, though, because not a single person I know is actually pure in heart. You get a couple fairy tales where a prince shows up and he's pure in heart, but that's about where pure in heart people end, because we've all sinned and we've all don't exactly have pure hearts if you actually get to know the inside of yourself. And so then you got to wonder, okay, did Jesus just give us this beatitude for absolutely no one on the earth? Or is it just for himself that he said this? I don't think so, because you have to look at the psalm that it parallels a little bit. It says, "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully." I think it's supposed to not just mean those who are pure, like they're sinless, but pure as in they're pure of purpose. Pure as in their heart only goes after one thing. I think it's like just later on in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, brings up the same thing again. He says, you can't serve two masters. I think it's just like that. That it's people who act with integrity and honesty and actually have one God in their lives. One focus, one clear thing that you serve. And if you serve God, Jesus says you will get to see God. And moving on to the next beatitude, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." And it's important, I think, to note that this beatitude, well, first off, we all know what peacemakers are, right? That one's the easy one. People who stop the fighting, right? But remember the question that I was going to ask before I corrected myself and went back. Remember, go back to history. Does anyone remember what the Pax Romana is? What? Roman peace, yes. First service, nobody knew it. So I saw a couple head nods in here. But the Pax Romana is the Roman time of peace where Rome flexed its muscles enough that fighting across the world virtually stopped. There's a couple little outrisings of violence here and there, but they're shut down really quickly. There's a riot here, and then Rome's like, no more riot. This is the most peaceful time in all of history during the Pax Romana. And I think that's something very interesting to point out. Wars are a ridiculously common piece of life. We know that very clearly. But when Jesus comes on the scene, the world is actually the most peaceful it's ever been, and quite possibly has been for a very long time. And so you've got to wonder, and then who is Jesus talking about if it really is the most peaceful time that ever existed when Jesus says this beatitude? Does this mean maybe that Jesus intends something a little more than just those who stop fighting? I would think so. If you look at the Jewish concept of peace, it means a whole lot more than just stop fighting. The greeting shalom, you might have heard that greeting before, it means peace quite literally, but it means more than just peace. It's a good greeting because it's wishing someone a calm life and a calm soul. It's what it's wishing someone. It's not just saying, hey, I hope you don't punch someone in the face today. It's saying, I hope that your heart is at peace today. It's wishing someone a good life that's free of worries, a calm life without storms, a peaceful day at sea in your heart and mind and homes. That's the Jewish concept of peace. And I think that's what Jesus has in mind when he says, blessed are the peacemakers. It's blessed are those who bring this kind of peace. Blessed are those who make it their goal to calm the storms in other people's lives, whose goal it is to make other people's lives more peaceful, more calm, more serene, more at rest. The next beatitude is, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This specific beatitude, I've already mentioned, the next two verses are him clarifying, so I'll read those right away. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Earlier in the fourth beatitude, it's blessed are you because you hunger and thirst for righteousness. But now in this final beatitude, it's blessed are you when you are persecuted because you didn't just hunger and thirst for righteousness, you went after it and sought it out, and people took notice and got upset at you for going after righteousness. You pursued it to the point that people took notice, is this beatitude. But as Jesus reminds us, they persecuted the prophets. And those guys were hungry and thirsting and going after righteousness. So they're going to persecute you as well. Jeremiah is the easiest example of one that was persecuted. He's got a very long book of prophecy, and throughout the entire thing, he's getting persecuted. There's not one good verse to read about it because he gets beaten up time and time again. If you read through the book, you'll see that he was beaten up by his own brothers. He was placed on the stocks. He was thrown in prison by the king. He was then threatened to be killed. He was then thrown into a cistern by royal officials. He was then directly attacked by false prophets. And at the end of the book, when Nebuchadnezzar comes and takes over the nation, he finds Jeremiah in his own nation's prison. And Nebuchadnezzar is the one who sets him free and is nice to him. And when you're attacked for doing what is right and for speaking out in truth, just as long as you do it in reflection of the other Beatitudes, poor in spirit, meek, you're merciful, for example, if you're righteous and yet you're treated like you've done wrong, then congratulations to you. You're in the lineage of following in the footsteps of the great men and women of God who've gone before and who were to be celebrated for the ages. Perhaps they weren't celebrated in their own age, and perhaps they weren't ever celebrated by the majority of people, but you're following a lineage of pretty good people, including Christ, who was killed for doing only good things. You'll be in pretty good company. And so that's the one that most easily illustrates this constant stream of these eight Beatitudes of the Sermon on the Mount. I flew through them, but maybe you noticed the common theme. It's often quite the opposite of what you would expect. It's congratulations for being something that everybody else is going to think is really not a good situation to be in. But someone with a kingdom perspective actually can understand that these are the greatest places to be in. It's not having it all together. It's not being blessed in the here and now, but you will be blessed in the age to come. And so congratulations for suffering through whatever's going on right now, because later on it's going to be a whole lot better. The world thinks you're not worthy of congratulations now, but you are. Congratulations because you're blessed, those who are poor in spirit, both physically poor and from working hard, those who feel sometimes like you're only spinning the wheels but going nowhere. Congratulations because you're blessed, those who are sorrowful because of how imbalanced and uneven and imperfect this world is, and you actually take the time to notice that it's not like God originally intended. Congratulations because you're blessed, you who are meek and patient because you wait on God's timing. Congratulations because you're blessed, those who thirst for those things that are right. Not falling for the fast food of an immoral society, you pursue that which lasts and that which Jesus promised would never leave you thirsty again. Congratulations, you are blessed, those who show mercy. You share with those who don't deserve it because God gave to you who did not deserve it either. Congratulations because you're blessed, those who are single-minded in mind and purpose, who worship God alone and don't fall for anything or anyone else. You serve only one master. Congratulations, you who are blessed, because you make peace, those who make peace. You seek not just to stop fighting, but to make someone else's life calm. Congratulations, because you're blessed, those who are persecuted for doing right. You suffer now because you understand what comes later is more important. And why are you blessed? Because yours is the kingdom of heaven. And these statements, they're both a description and they're both descriptive and prescriptive of what life is like as a disciple of Christ. By doing these things, you're following after Christ, and this is what someone who follows after Christ does. And you might suffer for doing good, you might have to suffer through it, but all these Beatitudes are about putting others first instead of yourself, or putting God first instead of yourself. And I know that's not the way the world treats us, and that's not the way the world acts, but blessed are you when you do put others first, when you are merciful, when you are meek, when you are hungering and thirsting for things to be better on this world. Blessed are you because you get to receive the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you because you get to see God. Blessed are you because God's going to be merciful towards you. Jesus is offering citizenship in his kingdom free of charge. And yes, this is what citizens of his kingdom do. But blessed are you for trying, because you get to see the kingdom of heaven. Those who give up or miss out on this life get to be first in line for the better life that is to come. And honestly, Jesus did not teach a whole lot. There's not that much in the Gospels that Jesus taught. There's a few sermons, and a lot of them are short, like I said. But when he did teach, the words that we do have recorded, we see that they are very powerful and wise words. He picked his words much more carefully than any of us choose or pick our words today. And when he does open his mouth, like the very first, right before the Sermon on the Mount began, when he does open his mouth, what does he say? He says to the hurting ones who strive to do right and they seek redemption of all things, he tells those people that you are blessed. Congratulations to you, even if no one else in this world is going to tell you congratulations. You are blessed. And he says this from the mountaintop. The Gospel of Matthew says it's the mountain. It doesn't ever tell us which mountain, but for some reason it's the mountain, not just a mountain, which makes you reminisce sort of Moses on Mount Sinai or David on Mount Zion. Jesus announces from this, making this declarative statement, he's announcing to those who hurt and those who thirst and those who mourn, saying, you get to see the kingdom of God. And so I've got one final question, and it's, are you blessed? And I don't mean the count your many blessings one by one question, are you blessed? Everyone's blessed. We've got countless blessings. We know that. I'm talking, are you blessed like these Beatitudes say that you're blessed? Are you poor in spirit? Do you mourn for the lack of good in this world? Are you meek and submissive to God's timing? Do you hunger and thirst for righteousness? Do you show mercy? Are you pure in heart? Are you a peacemaker? Are you so dedicated to righteousness that the world persecutes you because of it? If so, blessed are you. You are blessed for those things. If not, the kingdom of heaven can still be yours. And so, won't you join in that great reversal today? You follow in the Beatitudes, where the world thinks it's silly, but it really is something to be congratulated and blessed for. The payoff probably won't come now, but you'll get to see God's face. And that would be an awesome moment. Jesus is offering that citizenship in heaven for free of charge. And he's telling us how we can go about doing that. We should listen to him. If you'd like to discuss that, come and talk with me as I stand here in the front. When we stand and sing in just a moment, we can talk about joining in that great reversal with the payoff that comes in the next life that won't even compare to anything you go through in this life and makes it all worth it. So please pray with me.